Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, everyone, and you're very welcome to this week's Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh. I'm joined by Tillage Editor Andy Doyle, and we're recording on Wednesday afternoon this week. Coming up, we're going to talk about varieties and recommended lists, check in on the grain markets and weather, hear what happened at the Chagas Crops Forum, and we have more from our Tramlines event, which happened last week. To start off, Andy, I suppose in the field, there's still crops being cut. I know on the Tramlines pages this week, Michael Grant is finishing his spring oats, I'd say, as we speak, maybe. And at the event last week, I spoke to quite a few farmers who had beans to cut as well.
Yeah, Siobhan, that's probably not surprising. You know, it's still very early for the crop, all things told.
Yeah.
But we've had a lot less ripening weather over the past 3 weeks compared with the 3 weeks before that again. So while they were coming fast for a while, it's not surprising that everything got slowed down. I was just in a yard today where beans had been cut probably the bones of a fortnight ago. And there was bits of sprouting in the pile because it had been left out for a while before it was put under cover. But I have to say that I was very impressed with the quality of the beans. You know, the early reports early in the season that beans hadn't filled very well certainly wasn't mirrored in what I was seeing. They were really full beans with virtually nothing in terms of a shape of a belly on the beans. So They had to have been doing well. And the other thing that I'm seeing around is a huge amount of regrowth in stubbles all over the place all of a sudden.
There really is, yeah.
Yeah, certainly a burst in grass as well, which is evident, but a lot of regrowth, a lot of volunteers coming up in stubbles and in sown crops. It's probably good that they're coming up now, that they can be dealt with a little bit earlier in the course of the herbicide regime. And I was delighted looking at MET numbers earlier in the week to see that the Northwest had escaped the bulk, or in some instances, all of the rainfall that the Eastern Seaboard suffered in the last week, which is critical for them to get a half a chance to be able to wrap up the last of the harvest. They deserve a bit of a break having had a bad year.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And ploughing next week, Andy, I suppose we're at that time of the year again where we're trying to hold people back from going out sowing. And I know it's a thin line if the weather breaks and there's no crops in, but look, next week is very early to be going out with the drill.
Yes, Siobhan, and I have little doubt in the world that there's people probably even at it this week. But it's phenomenally early. And I think one of the things that we always have to kind of just remember is that early isn't necessarily just a mark or a day or a number on the calendar. It's really much more to do with how much growth is going to come after your planting. And last year we were particularly badly hit because we planted relatively early, but growth continued almost up to the end of February, and that probably brought a lot of its own risks, problems and pressures that certainly added to the problems down the south in the year gone by. Well, specifically on winter barley, thank God most other crops were very good. So, you know, I was mentioning to people that you can get over one of the ills by, say, opting for winter barley and planting Jiayu in the belief that it, that the tolerance that it's supposed to have offers something real and tangible. And it may do that for BYDV, and we certainly hope it is doing that for the different viruses. But it doesn't get over the risk of take-all. It doesn't get over the risk associated with significant grass weed germination and establishment with very early planting, or indeed the risks associated with foliar diseases either. So like, they're all very real. One or other of them, or any of them, can do you. So that's where the balance comes in. But the decision as to when to plant and what to plant is, it has to be done on a field and farm basis. I don't think we can tell anybody absolutely when they can or they can't move. But if you know you're moving or you've moved early, then you should also know that you have extra precautions you have to take, which invariably cost more money. And, you know, this is not an era where we want to be seen to be spending luxuriously, whatever about sensibly.
Yeah, and like, as we move into sowing season, we need to keep it, to remember what happened at harvest, and, you know, look at the crops that didn't perform as well, and what was the reason for that. And, you know, as we talked about harvest on the podcast, it was evident that there was some crops that didn't perform to their best. You know, there was an association there with early planting, and I think people just need to keep that in mind. But as you said, look, every field and farm is different.
It's probably also, Siobhan, important to say that, you know, there was a lot of fields that did very, very well this year that were technically sown early, and they didn't suffer any disadvantage. But just because they didn't suffer a disadvantage for that location this year doesn't mean that they won't suffer a problem next year. And that's the risk. You know, you can take a risk on any one or two or three fields, depending on how many you have, but to start risking everything is where the risk gets very big. And that's why, you know, you can certainly, people will have to do some early sowing on very awkward land, but the big challenge is, should you stay going once you start? And that's the really difficult one for people, because once you've started, the easiest thing is to stay in gear. And if you end up with everything sown relatively early, now your whole farm business is actually at risk. An unknown risk, I might add as well, because you don't quite know what one is going to get you.
Yeah. The recommended list came out the winter barley was the end of last week, and winter wheat and oats this week, Andy, and they're on the tillage pages this week. And we won't go into too much detail on them because, look, people like to read through them themselves. But I suppose, looking first of all to winter barley, Jiayu is now fully recommended, along with Tardis, and Bordeaux and SY Armadillo are provisionally recommended, and quite a few varieties have left the list. So Valerie, Pixel and Cosmos are gone, and, you know, quite a really good choice of varieties on that list now this year, Andy. Cassia is still there, like, and still top of the pile for KPH. I think Tardis is quite an attractive one there for people on two rows as well, and of course Belfry, probably the big six row on the list. But plenty of choice of really good varieties there this year.
Yeah, and a big choice of varieties on the winter barley list, and six rows, hybrid and non-hybrid, kind of standing out above the two rows, but not by very much. So it's very interesting to see how Tardis is performing relative to the six rows there.
Yeah, absolutely. And Andy, you were looking at the winter wheat and the oats list. Not much change there, certainly on the oats anyway. I know Barra has left that list after being, was it 1986 that was first recommended?
1986, Siobhan, I think I've been credited with cutting the first piece of Barra in plots that was grown in the country down in Cork.
Oh, really?
Yeah, long before 86, probably in the very early 80s. And, you know, it's after spanning virtually my whole professional career, and even more than that in the Farmers Journal. 36 years of virtually constant delivery, a variety that was good from the word go. It would have yielded 4 ton an acre back in the 1980s. It still probably was only delivering 4 ton an acre now, but it was interesting over all of those decades to see a gap opening up between a new variety and Barra, and then a year later or 2 years later, what might have been a 10 or a 12 or a 13 point gap, kind of contracting back to eight points again. So nobody was able to get completely away from it. But as against that, it was outclassed yield wise and standing wise. And of course, we all accepted for a long time it had been very susceptible to disease. So, it's a loss, but it's probably not an economic loss. It's more of a sentimental, or maybe even more so an iconic loss to the oat growers.
The breeders are keeping it in cold storage as well. So I know Goldcrop said that at their open day that the genetics will be there for the future anyway.
Yeah, well, look, it brought a lot, and it was a variety that was exclusive to Ireland and probably even to say that to the Republic of Ireland, because it was something that never really was kind of safely taken on board north in the north of Ireland.
Okay.
But it has done so well for so long that it will be a small note of sadness probably to see it go, but also a note that it represents progress, and the progress that has to be recognized is the fact that it survived all that length of time because of its quality, which could never be met by any other variety up to relatively recently. And now we have both Husky and Isabel that can equal and surpass the specific weight of Barra, and probably that happening at a time when people realize that maybe specific weight isn't exactly the be all and end all of quality in oats, depending on the market, but it certainly was the driver for just so many decades. And then Siobhan, just before we leave that to go on to wheat, we all reckoned that Dawson was a candidate variety. We reckon that it would be able to be good enough to be recommended, and it has been recommended. It's come on as provisionally recommended onto the winter wheat list, and Conross, which was recommended last year, has been discontinued in a sense to make way, because there's only so many varieties that the trade can carry at any given time, carry and multiply. So, you know, it's good to have it there. It's come on. I can't remember the number offhand, at 102, 103, I think, one or other. Spearhead has gone from provisionally recommended to fully recommended with a yield of 104. It's the highest yielder on the list. Yeah. But, you know, it's important that people remember that you don't just look at yield. And
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, for people kind of looking down the list, Spearhead with the highest yield, it might be a variety that's worth having, but you can't risk a massive area of it because it's seen as relatively prone to sprouting, as is Inciter, both high yielding varieties. But we just have to be careful about not having too much exposure to one, either or both of those varieties in your choices.
Yeah, absolutely, Andy. Yeah. Andy, you went to the crops farm last week as well, and I know that's where the department came with the varieties at that event. But there was a lot going on at the crops farm last week, and we have some of the stories in the paper from it, and we'll have a lot more in due course. But what stood out for you at that event?
A couple of quick things, Siobhan. Firstly, in presenting the varieties that the variety performance in 2022 and a look towards the recommended lists, Cara McAdon from the department told us that they have been operating a BYDV assessment trial on winter barley varieties. 2 years done, and they're planting the third year of trials. Is probably now already planted in terms of putting varieties under pressure. And he flipped up a photograph of two that showed, you know, massive difference in terms of the level of yellowing in one variety versus another. in that assessment. So, you know, we await that with great interest, because we'd like if the department could verify claims of tolerance and then to what degree the newer varieties coming on stream that are said to carry even more robust tolerance and even resistance down the road, to what degree those varieties will actually be able to yield, perform and fend off that particularly difficult foe in the back end where very small numbers create a very big problem. So that was one thing that kind of caught me. Then Fran Moran from the Department of Agriculture was talking about the new CAP scheme and the regulations and how entitlements in particular will be affected, talked about the impact of CRIS and the impact of moving to BIS, etc., and the fact that BIS, the BIS element of your entitlement is the only bit that's subject to capping, and that will be significantly lower. So, you know, people need to get onto the department's website and just do the sums for themselves on their own entitlement number and value, etc. He also told us that the sale of entitlements in 23 and 24 will not be subject to any clawback, and that's there to facilitate the transfer of ownership of entitlements between people who may have difficulty standing them up in the future or whatever, you know, justifying them, or people that just only have entitlements, you know, that there is that window there to do it for 2 years. He also told us that there will be no clawback for full rental. There were calls earlier in the year that if people were renting out all their entitlements, that those entitlements should be subject to clawback. That was muted for a while, but it isn't the case. It isn't going to happen. And one thing in particular that he emphasised at the end of it, Siobhan, was what he called circumvention, which in a sense is people looking at the rules and deciding, well, if we do this or that, we could be able to avoid some entitlement value loss or maybe avoid capping or something like that. And, you know, he said that circumvention is something that is a serious element of the next cap. And if people are found to be in breach, if they're doing things that are illegal to either gain more money or avoid cuts, that the penalties for that are likely to be very severe in the year ahead.
So that's splitting payments or something like that, basically what he's saying there.
It could be one of a lot of things. And, you know, at the end of the day, we can say with some pride that farmers in general are pretty good at finding ways around things. And it's just that it's not that there isn't scope to find a way around things, but we just have to be careful that it is completely kosher, because if it's not, it could have unexpected and unintended consequences.
Okay. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. And Shea Phelan was talking about a machinery sharing agreement, Andy.
Yeah, Siobhan, that's come up for in conversation at many fora over the past number of years. And, you know, we talk a lot about it and generally do nothing. But Shea made the point that, you know, the average tillage farm is about 60 hectares. And 60 hectares doesn't justify owning every machine. You could argue that it doesn't justify owning any machine, but I think a lot of people wouldn't like to feel totally dependent on others. But when you stand back from that statement, you know, the idea of a number of people in that size category being able to come together to share machines is a way around the impasse that's there and the risk that's there in the future. So what Shea has done, he's not, in a sense, given an absolute recipe that people can follow or people should follow, but rather a discussion document that helped people to discuss the variables and to come to a solution that best suits their needs. So Shea was kind of always quick to emphasize, this is not my document. This is not a Chagas document. This will be the document of the people who engage in the conversation, because every conclusion will be different. And it's just a way of getting people to regularize their attitude to machinery, to be able to find a way to formally share it, to cope with repairs along the way, to cope with an ending of the agreement and to cope with what happens if the machine, if the sharing is still there and the machine is due for renewal. All those things need to be sorted out in advance. And all he's doing is outlining these things. What are we going to do in all of these?
There's so many things to think of. And look, it's certainly makes sense. And when you say like the average size of the farm is 60 hectares, I would say on it, you know, grass weeds is a problem that, you know, faces us all. So you'd probably want to be doing it with someone, you know, fairly well, and that you know their farm and what kind of weeds are in it. And, you know, maybe it'd be a local farmer. They need to be local anyway, if you're sharing a machine. But, you know, I think grass weeds has to be to the forefront of people's minds when they're doing a machinery agreement as well.
Yeah, that governs who you can share with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And Siobhan, one of the things that Shay said, just a kind of as a by the way, and, you know, it's something that I've heard many times before with the relatively small number of people who have opted to share on machines in the past. And that's the fact that the hidden benefit is the fact that your partner or partners all of a sudden have a vested interest in sharing in your job. They want the machine to be finished in your field so that they can get it. And they're there doing other jobs. And all of a sudden, like a number of people said this to me over the years, the great unseen benefit is the fact that it becomes a lot less lonely place at certain times of the year because you have other people coming to help.
Which is really important as well.
It's increasingly important as time goes on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you're sharing a machine with someone, you know, you talk things out with them and you discuss each other crops and give each other a bit of help and advice. And certainly learn from one another. Andy, while we're on machines, I think we'll move to tramlines. And we had our tramlines event last week. And for anyone who missed the podcast last week, we had the talks from Phelim Dolan and Liam Dunphy and Liz Lynn on last week's podcast about grain markets, fertilizer, and some of the future plant protection products. But Andy, you spoke to Dermot Forrestal at the event. And it was a really good chat, and we just have a snippet of the chat here now. So it's yourself and Dermot, and you're talking about stubble cultivations. And towards the end of the conversation, Dermot has some really interesting things to say about the depth of ploughing as well. So we'll take a listen.
We have Paul, and maybe I didn't say it, we didn't say it clearly enough. Paul does cultivation as a matter of form.
Yeah.
For a lot of people now, we're forced into cultivation for the first time.
Yeah.
And leave aside the winter-spring element of it. If a guy is going to cultivate stubbles in the autumn to enhance vegetation, to act as a herbicide, act as a stale seed bed, all of those reasons, how should he be thinking of it? What should he be doing?
I think you have to kind of see what you are actually trying to achieve. Like, obviously, the one at the moment is green cover because we've been forced to do it for that reason. So you're trying to capture nutrients and so on. But you mentioned the other one, which would be for stale seed beds. But you could also be doing stubble cultivation maybe for slugs, you know, to try and reduce slug numbers. You could also, in a mint-till situation, it could be the start of your cultivation process in terms of soil preparation for seeding. So it depends really on what you're trying to achieve. And for many, you're trying to combine some or all of those together in one cultivation. And sometimes there's a bit of a conflict there in what you're trying to achieve.
And look, the question that everybody kind of would throw up, first of all, is the tool. Disc, tine, type of disc, weight of machine, etc.
Yeah, there's big differences there. I mean, they even go back from that. You're talking about maybe straw combing or whatever, which is kind of much more minimal in terms of cultivation. So in terms of, you know, trying to get the seeds that are there chitted, if that's what your aim is, I think, you know, a lot of people would say, or not a lot of people, but there's some work which would say that we don't really need to go deep at all. But what you want to do is get a bit of disturbance in all of the soil surface. And that's the idea behind, I suppose, the simpler straw combing and things like that, that they may be doing enough in that situation to get the seeds that are on the surface chitted. And there's a lot of interest in the machinery side as well and going into the ultra-low depth, you know, like the Vaderstad cross-cutter and implements like that, which are designed to be really, really shallow, ultra-shallow in terms of their cultivation. So they're just moving the top couple of centimetres of soil in that case. But then the more traditional stubble cultivation, which can also be shallow, is done with kind of tine or disc machines, or indeed some that combine both. And I suppose, you know, the pros and cons of those, the tine tends to be very flexible in terms of depth, okay? Because you can configure them with different shares on them to do different things, and they will work deep if you want them to work. And some people are working non-inversion tillage maybe with those implements down as much as 150 millimetres or maybe 6 inches or maybe more. So the time gives you the choice of doing that. But you can also equip them with shares that will work very wide, shares that will work very shallow, and you can actually work at 50 to 75 millimetres deep maybe in that situation. The disc isn't as flexible, I suppose, yeah, in terms of depth. You can buy different discs. You know, you saw there was a Helidor there on the way in from Lemken, but Lemken would sell you two different types of discs. They'll sell you a Ruben disc as well, which will work slightly deeper than the Helidor type. So your disc is a little bit more restricted in terms of the depth with which it will work, depending also on soil moisture. But again, the disc will tend to, you know, if you're on a stony site, it's not going to take up stones as much maybe as some of the Tynes machines will.
Dermot, one of the points you mentioned, and it was interesting, because we both know of instances where people are operating down to, probably 12-plus inches with Mint Hill systems, because they're trying to put out a fire where a problem is ongoing and being exacerbated over time. But if you take the more normal down to 125, 150 mil, should people realistically try to vary that deepest depth every couple of years to loosen up again?
Yeah, I think there's a certain logic there. Like, if you're in any system that involves cultivation, I suppose the one that's different is if you're in a no-till. But if you're in anything that involves cultivation, you are going to generate a kind of a layer, a difference, I suppose, in terms of consolidation or if it's too much compaction. Because they're one and two ends of the one coin, if you like, beneath where that's working.
Yeah.
So depending on your conditions, that layer then will also bear the brunt of traffic. So that'll tend to compound what's there. So that layer may become too tight. So yes, I think there's a certain logic in being able to vary the depth. And this even comes to ploughing. Like, I think in many cases, we probably plough too deep a lot of the time, and we'd be far better ploughing a lot shallower. Nobody ever told us for cereals that we need to plough deep, but yet we're now ploughing a hell of a lot deeper than generations before us. So there's a lot of benefit in any tillage tool, I suppose, if you are cultivating. In working as shallow as you can, maybe, you know, in terms of what you need to do. But occasionally, if that transition layer, that layer beneath where the tool is working, becomes too tight because it has continually cultivated that level, because that's where the traffic is effectively supported and so on, there is benefit maybe in varying the depth in certain occasions, yeah.
So that was yourself, Andy, and Dermot Forrestal from Chagas, who we'd like to thank for coming along to the Tramlines event last week. And that Tramlines event was held on Paul O'Connell's farm in Ballabritis. And it's a farm that a lot of people know well. It's a farm in the past would have, it's on the side of the M7, I suppose. It's located near the canal and the Barrow as well. So it's a farm that's known to a lot of people, and it's known probably because it used to flood as well. But Andy, we'll pick up with Paul here. Paul solved the problem of the flooding. So we'll just pick up here now, and Paul is describing how he got to the bottom of that.
We haven't seen floods for a long time. Did you manage to get it fixed, and where did the problem come from originally?
Yeah, well, back in the 70s, when the land was originally drained, my father did a certain amount of banking up on the ground, and that kept the water fairly well out. And then the motorway came along, and I think it was 03. And when the motorway was finished, the left of that wasn't banked up the way it was originally. So it was a few years there before we decided to get back and bank it up properly again. And we put a pump on it as well to keep the water off when the high rainfall does come, or when the river level rises. So to say you have it solved, keeping water away is always a bit of an issue, and the river's in a dreadful state regards to being cleaned and whatnot, so we're always trying to get them to do work on it and keep it, but there's always pushback regards not doing anything that end as well. So we find that the water levels are just coming higher and higher, and certainly with the rainfall the way it has been the last number of years, you're getting this big downpours in a number of days, like, you know, so you could get 2 to 3 inches there in a day or two, and that puts a lot of pressure on everything. So, but we have kept it out the last 7 or 8 years, and we've got a crop off the field, so that's kind of our aim.
And you, Paul, you've said you're pumping it. Can you just explain what you've done? Because pumping just sounds instantly like a very expensive operation.
Yeah, well, the field, as I said, was originally drained, so it's all drained to one point. And from that point, we have put in a screw auger pump, and it's powered by electricity from the farmyard here. So it takes about 2 kilowatts of power. So it's able to move about, I think, about 3,000 to 4,000 litres a minute. So that'll keep most of the water off. And then if it's a higher pressure, we can put some more centrifugal pumps on, ran by a generator. But that's more work, obviously, keeping fuel in a generator and keeping keeping them running. But, yeah, it's working anywhere. It's on its edge, but it is working. Like, you know, it keeps the crop from being underwater for too many days. Like, if it's the dormant time of the year, the crop will survive underwater for, let it be, 10 to 12 days. So we don't mind the drop of water out, but just not to take the crop out of it.
But at least that explains why people don't see the lake going up and down the M7 anymore, or the occasional lake.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I know it does be a lot smaller and for a lot shorter time, so that does be kind of our aim, you know. So now, if it was in the, during when the plant was actively growing, you would have to keep all the water off, because it would take very little water to damage it, you know.
Okay, let's just get back to the farming operation as a whole. What area, roughly, are you covering?
Yeah, we're covering around 850 acres. It's kind of mostly winter crops. So we aim to get in winter crops, because just for the higher yield and a bit more profitable. So we've about 50% winter barley, 40% winter wheat, and the other 10% then is winter oilseed rape. So,
and would you absolutely try to stay away from spring crops, or are you allergic to them? Probably is the best way to answer that question.
Well, if you get a wet September or a wet October, you could end up with a lot of spring crops again, you know. So that'd be, the weather of October plays a big part in it. But no, I just like getting in winter crops, get the workload out of the way, and then if you do get, let it be a dry spring or whatever, the crops are in the ground and they're able to tolerate the weather better. They're established.
And have you a fixed rotation running, Paul, or relatively fixed rotation running?
I like, my favourite crop's definitely winter barley, because I just find it's the easiest crop to grow to get consistent yields. It's just a consistent crop. So that's, anywhere that the winter barley is yielding relatively okay, I leave it be and I go continuous winter barley. And then there's some ground that is the lower lying ground, and that is suitable for wheat, and it's producing fairly okay yields for wheat. So, and then any of the problem fields, they're the ones that end up going into, let it be, a break crop of some description, whether it's beans or whether it's oilseed rape.
And will you follow them with?
Winter wheat after the oilseed rape.
Take a short preference for barley in those?
No, I know. The wheat obviously is good after the break crop. So that is the big advantage of the break crop, is that you have the ground to put the wheat in and hopefully get the kick from the break crop, you know.
And Paul, would you see it as a really big disaster if you did get a dirty wet back end and you didn't get a lot of winter crop? Is spring yield potential much, much lower on a lot of the land you're farming?
A good lot of it is. And I suppose also the land that has been traditionally left for the spring barley is the poorer ground, the ground that didn't get sowed. So maybe my view is slightly skewed from that point of view of spring crops, because it was the poorer land that was left. And then I was saying, oh, look, my spring crops didn't yield, but it was the poorer 20% of the farm that was left because it wasn't fit to sow in the autumn. So, you know, and also spring crops seem to have come up. Certainly this year they yielded quite well again. So from talking to neighbours, so it's kind of, you know, certainly something I'm not completely.
And can I ask just for a rough idea of the kind of yields that you will have got this year, in as much as you know them, or because you have grain and shed and you do have a weighbridge, I suppose, which helps to keep a handle on it?
Yeah. Well, the winter barley averaged, I think, 3.9, and all the crops were fairly consistent, so there was no real good crops and no real bad crops. The winter wheat was anywhere from 4.75 down as low as 3 tonne, so there was big variations there, let it be whether they're dry fields or there was a bit of a take-all issue in some places. So there was a big variation in the wheat, but the winter barley was very consistent.
Great to hear from Paul there, and he's talking about his crop yields as well. It was a really great event, Andy, and thanks very much to Paul for hosting the event and being so honest in his account of how he got on in the farm this year as well.
Yeah, hear to that, Siobhan, because it's always a big deal to ask anybody to open their farm up to others and to discuss the business of the farm in situ with everybody listening. It's a big deal, and any farm that does that for any enterprise deserves thanks.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely is. And look, we have those talks as well from the event, and we'll get them up online on the website. I know we had snippets on the podcast, but we'll get them up online, the full talks, in the next few days. So Andy, we'll move to grain markets, and positive is the word I'd use on grain markets this week, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable word to use, Siobhan. Over the weekend, or leading up to the weekend, there was a significant rise in price. For the last few weeks, we'd seen futures prices kind of oscillate between, normally between kind of 312, 314, up to maybe 326 at the top end. And it was one day it was at the top end finishing, the other day it was at the low end finishing. But leading up to the weekend, there was a significant hike. Last Friday, for the first time since pretty much the end of June, we saw prices rise well above the 330s, and it closed on Friday at 337. Now, I'm talking December futures Matif prices, not completely related at all to actual physical prices for farms, but it does reflect a sentiment in the market, and the sentiment basically was suggesting that, well, prices should be up. Now, I understand that with the benefit of hindsight, a lot of the driver for that price increase was technical, as in people doing things for a certain specific reason that made sense to markets. So when we turned into Monday, markets eased off slightly again. But Monday evening was close to the equivalent of Monday morning in the US, when the United States launched its WASDA, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, across all commodities, but the ones that interest us are grains. And it caught the market by surprise when it indicated that the area sown to maize and the area sown to soybeans was actually lower than had been predicted earlier in the season. For the past number of reports, we're very conscious that the yield levels in certainly in parts of the US have been very badly hit by drought during the growing season. But the fact that the acreage is lower than was estimated kind of caught everybody offside. And it would seem that, you know, normally you drop soya and you gain maize, or you drop maize and you gain soya. It's kind of a seesaw between the two. But to have both dropping was really what caught people off guard. And it seems that the acres migrated into cotton production. Because the price of cotton, I remember hearing last year, had really gone up in the moon, kind of the equivalent of oilseed rape prices for us. And that certainly seems to have attracted in a lot of acres. So the fact that we had lower acres of corn and soybean then basically meant that supply was going to be even tighter than had been predicted. So we began to see the start of that price rise in Europe on Monday evening. And then Tuesday brought a further price increase. But, you know, realistically, it's not gone any further than Friday evening. It oscillated yesterday. It went up as far as 340, if I'm not mistaken. 338. No, that was last Friday. It's just been hopping around the kind of the 330, 337 mark. And as we speak at the moment, it's on 336.50, having closed on Tuesday night at 336.25. So it's just kind of sitting there. It's not going mad on the basis of the US numbers, because there's all the uncertainty that's there over Black Sea. And I think the market is really watching what's going to happen on Thursday in the talks over the Black Sea grain corridor, and the talks with Turkey and the Ukraine, Turkey and Russia and Ukraine, etc., where Russia has kind of said that it believes the corridor isn't working because too much of the grain is going to countries that are not classified as poor countries, which was technically the reason why the corridor was put in place in the first place.
Okay.
So there's fears that the corridor may not stay open.
Yeah. So that people will be watching that next week. Andy, I don't have the Malton price this week, but it's getting near the end of the averaging. for this season, and we'll get it for next week. It was last at 4:05. Weather, Andy, what will people be looking at this week?
Well, it's one of the more pleasant ones to be able to report, Siobhan, in that the vast majority of the country is looking at zero for rainfall for the next week. Stephen's back with us, we all know, at this stage, but the fate of the Northwest, it's still mentioned in real terms for rain, but hopefully most of the work is done. And rainfall amounts are small, very small, you know, 2 millimetres, 1 millimetre, 1 millimetre, which means that you might get a shower and you might not, or there might be a mist in the morning. And if the wind rose, the thing could blow off again pretty quickly. But it's nice to see all those zeros. What I would really like to see is, looking beyond that, to be able to get to the 22nd, 23rd, 24th of September being a preferable start to planting. Because it's just a safer time to be doing it. But I still think that people will be going this week. But we've got to remember that, you know, there are significant risks, as we discussed earlier. Wind speeds, generally winds coming out of the south and the west, but moving around to the north as in from Thursday. And that's very definitely reflected in temperatures, particularly nighttime temperatures, where nighttime temperatures for Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, 4, 3, 5, 5. You know, we haven't seen those temperatures since way back in probably mid-springtime. So we'll certainly begin to feel the chill at nighttime very, very quickly. But as forecasted at the moment, but day and nighttime temperatures forecasted to pick up again next week, and in particular towards the middle of next week. And we'll hope from there afterwards that there will be another relatively dry spell to enable field work and planting to be done.
Thanks very much, Andy. Yeah, and you know, plenty of jobs being done, plenty of hedge cutting and everything in preparation for winter crops. So great to have good weather to do it in. And I know a lot of people are preparing machinery and things like that now as well. So, you know, stay safe doing those jobs on the farm. And you know, it's still very busy on farms, but there's no real late nights or anything at the minute. So you know, look after yourselves while you have that bit of a break.
Siobhan, before we break, can I just make reference to something that I mentioned at the Tillage Forum last week?
Yeah.
And that is that, you know, while we are aware now of a lot of the pressures that are coming on us in the year ahead, in 2023 in particular, I'm also aware of the ones that are still in the incubation stage, and in particular the revision of the Sustainable Use Directive.
Yes.
And that's currently open for public consultation, where people have an opportunity just to say that how the proposals, which is either to cut pesticide use by 50%, and we've already achieved a chunk of that in Ireland, and in Ireland we have a relatively low pesticide use on average, because we have so many acres that get no pesticides, and that's a huge help to us. But nonetheless, we would still have to be reducing our total amount relative to what we have used in the past. Plus, there's suggestions in there of having to get access to independent advisors to clear the use of pesticides going forward, and many other things. There are some areas that would be designated as being important for nature, where pesticide use would be banned completely. The loss of pesticide use on any amenity areas for any use. All of those things are there, and people can be affected in different ways. And, you know, if somebody feels they're going to be affected, the public consultation is the time to actually go ahead and actually make a statement. You don't have to give an epistle. It's not a question and answer session. It's just to say how these measures individually might affect you. And if only one of them really hits you bad, address that one. But if we don't say it, we can't be blamed. If we don't say it, we can blame ourselves for what's going to come out the other end. Because while the proposals might be deemed as difficult at the moment, there's a lot of people out there making submissions who believe they're not going half far enough.
Yeah, if farmers don't get their speak in, there's no way to be heard. Andy, when do people have to have their consultation in by?
I'm saying it today, Siobhan, because it's a quick turnover. That stage of consultation closes on the 19th of September, which is it next Monday, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether the 19th is open for submissions or it's the last day of submissions, but you know, you'd really want to be thinking of getting it done over the weekend. And the more individual it is, the more weight that submission will carry.
Yeah, really important that farmers do participate in all of those types of consultations, but this one looked particularly relevant to tillage farmers. So thanks for that, Andy. And that's where we'll leave it for this week. So stay safe on the farm and keep the tillage flag flying.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.